The local barbershop is a place you'll often find men opening up about what's really going on in their lives. Sure, we go for a skin fade and a shave, but many of us also go for a chat. And a barber you keep going back to is one who knows how to listen. Grant is one such barber, using the chairs at his shop not just to make a living, but as a safe place for blokes to talk. Grant's personal experience includes a period of suicidality after being catfished. He faced major uncertainty moving from London to Australia and now juggles the challenge of being a first-time dad while running a business. He's also the son of a recovered drug addict who's been helping people overcome addiction for more than three decades.
Dad got given a second chance. I've sort of learned that everyone deserves it. If my dad didn't get a second chance, he wouldn't be here today. I wouldn't be here today. So the fact that he got a second chance and he is the person he is today, I believe that someone that's going through something, whether it's through drugs, alcohol, anxiety, mental health issues or anything, like, you can overcome them and you can come out a way better person afterwards. Like, you don't have to be labelled that scumbag forever.
All this has got Grant inspired, and on April 14, he's going to be cranking out haircuts for 24 hours straight to raise money for mental health through the Shaka Project. This is Grant Friedman's story. Welcome to Young Blood, the award-winning volunteer podcast dedicated to young men's mental health. My name's Callum McPherson. I'm a journalist, and this is a platform for everyday men to share lived experience stories and show that no matter what you're going through, you're not alone. Suicide is the number one killer of young people, and changing that starts with speaking up. So let's do it. If you haven't already, please subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss a thing. Help us reach more people by taking 10 seconds to give the show a rating on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And if you've got some feedback on this conversation, I'd love to hear it. You can vote in the poll and leave a comment on every Spotify episode. I read them all. This show touches on some tough topics that may provoke strong emotions. If you find anything in this chat distressing, please do whatever you need to do to look after yourself. Grant, what was it like for you growing up in the UK?
Honestly, pretty blessed, pretty spoiled in terms of had a loving family, had good set of friends. Early days, primary school, there was a classic bit of bullying and stuff in high school, but I feel like there's not really a lot of people these days that haven't experienced a bit of bullying. But honestly, pretty easy. I wasn't really a troubled upbringing or anything like that. It was good. I didn't get spoiled in terms of mum, dad, give me that and I got it. It was more got taught the right things, got taught the right values, and yeah, I'm pretty happy the way I was up, bro.
100%. What about your family? What are they like?
They were good. I was brought up in a sort of traditional Jewish household. I've got a brother, had a dog, and yeah, everyone was just, it was just always a happy sort of, always had family coming around. We always went to visit other family and everything. My parents got off to a super rocky start before me and my brother were born. My dad was, before my parents were married, my dad was an addict for about 7 years. He was alcohol, heroin, every sort of drug you could probably think of. He put it in him, but turned his life around and yeah, managed to bring up a pretty awesome family.
Tell us some more about his story. What's he told you about that time in his life?
There's so much. Yeah, it's started off, he probably wasn't the most popular guy and he started drinking to fit in. The high of alcohol wore off, he started smoking weed and coke, and eventually those highs wore off and moved on to the harder stuff and just fell into the underworld of drugs, sort of hanging around pimps, prostitutes, doing anything he could to get money to get his next score and stuff like that. And some of the things he's told us, you sort of look at it, it's like, I don't know how you're alive today. And if you saw my dad, you'd probably look at him and think, wow, I would never in a million years guess that you were that person. There's one story that pops up where he's, I hope I get it right, but he had these two girlfriends that were on the game, And I think it was him and a mate, they used to go to this motel or an apartment, something like that. And my dad would sit there with a baseball bat outside prostitute's room or sex worker's room. And he would just be there in case anything went wrong with a baseball bat. And I'm thinking, wow, that's my dad. It's weird.
That was sort of 9 to 5.
Yeah. And then my mum, bless her, she was super naive. I don't really think she had a clue what was going on. And she just thought he was tired a lot of time. And then eventually he told her that he was going into rehab. Really close to once their wedding invitations went out. Went into rehab for, I'm not sure how long he spent in there actually, but came out clean. Got in contact with the local rabbi actually. And he connected with him and they started off a charity that went on for over 20 years called the Drugs Line.
Wow.
And he went on to, it was essentially a telephone line. People used to call up addicted, on the brink of suicide and everything, and they would call up people like my dad and other people that were working the phones, and they would talk them out of it and essentially counsel them over the phone for no money at all.
Wow.
But yeah, it was amazing how he went from being such a horrible person to such a nice person. He didn't just come out and get clean. He like helped people as much as he possibly could. And he still does today. I have people asking for my number. Hey, what's your dad's number? Straight away, I know why they're asking, because they know someone that's struggling or they're struggling themselves or something like that. And yeah, 38 or 39 years later, he still goes on, helps people, goes to AA meetings, NA meetings, and I'd say I suppose he's sort of the reason I'm sort of the person I am today, if I'm honest.
Does he talk about a light switch moment where it changed for him in rehab or whenever it was?
If I'm honest, I don't think he's ever, you know, he probably has told me, and it's sort of a bit of a blur for me because there's there's just so many stories, and sometimes he'll tell me one, I'm like, how many more of these have you got? These random stories keep coming, and sometimes you look at them and you're like, surely that's not true. I mean, obviously he's not lying, but some of them are so far-fetched, you're like, geez.
Well, and so far from the man that you know.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he's such a gentle guy, and it's like, I can't imagine you acting like that. That was, like, crazy. You see it in TV shows. You see it in, like, these British gangster movies, and you're like, wow, you were doing that and worse things.
But addiction can happen to anyone, and people can 100%. Change as well. As you
yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of people that judge drug addicts or addicts in general. And I think one thing my dad taught me, that it doesn't have to be a drug or an alcohol that's addictive. Like, you can get addicted to anything. And if it alters the way you think or the way you act, it's addictive, because you're obviously enjoying the way that it's altering you. And yeah, you can get addicted to that feeling and
ego and status and
yeah, 100%
power over people.
Yeah, 100%. And again, a lot of people will judge someone for being addicted to something, and they'll cut them out and say, nah, that guy's a scumbag, or she shouldn't be doing that. And it's like, maybe they're just not well and they need a bit of help. And people like you judging
often
them.
A symptom of pain and
yeah,
problems going on in
yeah,
your
life. past traumas and stuff, or even stuff that you're going through at that point to try and make yourself feel better. And yeah,
no one wakes up and intends to be an addict.
No,
you just find yourself.
Yeah, 100%. And you'll get people that, technically speaking, are addicts, and their first thing they'll say is like, "Oh, I'm not an alcoholic. I don't drink a full bottle of whiskey every day." Or I don't drink in the mornings. I'm not an alcoholic. Like, that alcoholic, he wakes up and has a scotch in the morning. I don't do that. But it's like, but you also can't have a night out without getting pissed or having a line or...
And it's also, where does your society or culture or subculture draw the line and say, this is okay, this isn't okay.
Exactly.
And this, everyone comes up with their own idea of what that is. And then we generally base that on who we know and how they act.
Yeah, 100%.
Think, like, I'm not that bad because Barry, he's really fucked up.
Yeah, he's way worse than me.
Yeah.
He got pissed Saturday and Sunday. I just get pissed on Saturday.
And hang around people that make you feel better because you're not as 100%. Off the rails as they are.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean to say that if you do get on the weekends that you're an addict. Like, I've got, 90% of my friends, like, they all sort of, they dabble and, they have a good time and everything. I personally don't.
But it's different for everyone, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. It's the way you hold yourself.
Too, because lots of people can have a few drinks and they can leave it at that and be fine, and lots of people can't. And if you're on either side of the fence, it's a bit hard to understand how one can do that and then act so differently to you. But
yeah, absolutely.
We're all different. What is your dad's experience and the way he carries himself and the stuff he's done? What's that taught you about how to treat people?
Yeah, I suppose because dad got given a second chance, I've sort of learned that everyone deserves it. If my dad didn't get a second chance, he wouldn't be here today. I wouldn't be here today. So the fact that he got a second chance and he is the person he is today, I believe that someone that's going through something, whether it's through drugs, alcohol, anxiety, mental health issues or anything, like, you can overcome them and you can come out a way better person afterwards. Like, you don't have to be labelled that scumbag forever. Like, you can get better and you can be a really good person. It just takes a bit of willingness and you've got to want to do it.
End up using it as a force for good and something that gives you credibility to be able to speak in certain places and have an impact that you couldn't have had otherwise.
Yeah, 100%.
And I think it's really important that we don't just cast people aside and paint them with a one brush and say, oh, that's it, they're done for and they'll never be any better.
100%.
And you have to give people second chances and have faith in them. And that said, there's the other side of the argument where you give people 100 chances and they're still not willing to change and they're still causing a lot of havoc. So you can have empathy for people in that situation as well.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a lot of clients that come through the door and some guys will just sit there in silence. Some guys you'll have a laugh with, and then some guys, they'll pour their heart out to you. They don't even know you, and they just sit there and they're like...
That's probably why they do it.
Yeah, like a lot of people say that a barber's second job is being a therapist, and it's so true. Like, you don't have to be a nut job to see a therapist. Like, you really don't. And a lot of people think that you do. A lot of people won't go and see a therapist or a counsellor or whatever you want to call it because they feel like they're not crazy enough to hit that level yet. And it's like... You don't even really need to be going through depression or anything to see a therapist. It's just to get your thoughts in line sort of thing. And sometimes people come into the barbershop and they'll just talk and talk. They don't even realise they're doing it. And I'll stand there and I'll listen, I'll cut their hair. And they'll tell me things that I know they wouldn't have told a lot of people. And it's an amazing feeling for me because I've created that environment for them to feel comfortable enough to pour their heart out a little bit and tell me their experiences and what they're doing, what they're going through and stuff. It's a wicked feeling. It's sad, but at the same time, it's like, it's nice as well.
How do you take that on in the process of just doing your day job?
In one sense, I'm kind of used to it. And I've been through a bit. I haven't been through that much. There's people come in with stories and I'm like, whoa. But then at the same time, I understand that some people are just looking for someone to talk to. They're not looking for someone to tell them what to do next. And sometimes if someone comes in and they've said, I tried committing suicide last week, a lot of people will be like, whoa, shit, I don't really know what to say to you, sorry. But I've sort of approach things like, and it's happened a couple of times where people have come in and told me that. And as shocked as I am, at the same time, I just allow them to speak. And that's the best thing you can do is just talk about your issues. And I've got a little pad of paper with some numbers and different therapists and helplines. And I'll just give it to them and say, give these guys a call. I'm not a professional, I'm here to listen, but it sounds like you need to talk to someone, like, that someone may be qualified, and that's just how I deal with it. but at the same time, it's weird. It's nice for me in a way that they can open up to me, because I know that they wouldn't unload that stuff on a lot of people.
Yeah, and you're obviously that kind of person where you've got that energy about you where people feel safe to do that. And then I think just the context of the barbershop generally for men is one of the last spaces where men will comfortably go and open up, because typically they're talking to someone they don't know, or someone they only know as their barber who they don't see any other time.
Yeah.
And they trust that you're not going to go and tell other people about them specifically, because 100%. It's just, there's that atmosphere in a barbershop.
You're not allowed to, you know, you've got client confidentiality. You're not allowed to talk about other people. You're not allowed to tell people what colour hair or colour, like, stuff they're doing to their hair, because it's like they're essentially patients. But at the same time, you're not allowed to tell other people what's going on in other people's lives. You're just not allowed
to. And you just wouldn't anyway. But there's just that feeling of trust seems to exist in a barbershop.
Yeah.
And I think maybe just because it's like it's a masculine environment, but it's one of those few remaining places where people won't necessarily just be on their phone.
Yeah.
And there's often like other blokes around. Yeah. And then I think also the fact that, you know, they're looking in the mirror, you're not facing each other.
Yeah.
It's been said before that men would rather talk about stuff when they're side by side or they're engaged in some sort of activity.
I haven't heard that, but
whereas
that
women
makes sense,
would rather look at each other in the face.
Yeah.
And so perhaps the fact that you're actually facing away, I reckon it can make it easier.
Yeah, maybe.
In some respects as well.
Yeah. And going back to what you said about the masculine environment of the barbershop, when my business partners and I created our shop, I didn't want that masculine environment. I didn't want the black walls and black and gold chairs and how manly can I make
the
this
stereotype,
space.
Yeah,
I mean, look, we give out beer and we give out scotch because, I don't know, it helps guys kick back. Well, it helps people kick back. We have women, we have men, we have all sorts of people come through the doors, but the shop is essentially neutral colours. It allows anyone in and it's not too in your face. You've got plants everywhere and it's a nice space where you can literally just come in and chill. And I think that helps. I see a lot of reviews go up on Google and other places, and the first thing that people say, such an amazing space, instead of saying, oh, cuts are really good. The first thing they say is such an amazing place. The guys are really welcoming. And that's what I want to create. I didn't want this butch mentality where you're too cool to have a conversation about
open
your
up.
Feelings.
Yeah. So you were thinking about that consciously when you put the shop together, that you wanted it to be a space where you could have those kinds of conversations.
It wasn't so much at the beginning. I wanted to create that space. It was mainly for people with essential needs, kind of directed at people with autism, kids with autism. Because in the last shop that I worked in, I developed this clientele full of children that had autism. And it had a lot to do with the charity event that I did, which we'll probably get to. But when I opened the shop, I wanted it to be a welcoming place that wasn't too in your face for kids that found those sort of places daunting and mums that found those places daunting. And eventually it hit a point where this space ended up being welcoming for everyone. And I didn't realise it at the time, but it has become, and it's become a really big talking point, and the shop's fairly well known for its warm, nice atmosphere. I mean, look, you're coming in at the wrong time and we'll be talking about all sorts, but nine times at the time, it's always really cool and just really friendly and just chilled out for that reason. And yeah, I suppose we did go for it, but it's appealed to way more people than I thought it would.
And those times when guys have come in and dropped something heavy in terms of that load off their shoulders, how have they left those situations? You know, how have they left feeling, or what have they said to you afterwards?
I get a lot of messages afterwards, like guys will send me a text or they'll come in for their next haircut or send me a message on Instagram or something. They'll just say, mate, thanks so much for the chat. Like, always love coming to see you. Something along the lines of that. But yeah, they get up, we have a big old hug, and then they pay for their haircut and they leave. And it's just like, I don't really know how they feel after this. Sometimes some people might feel regretful that they've just told me that.
I don't think so. I think they'd find it cathartic most of the time.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I guess.
Maybe a bit surprised that they ended up saying that much.
Yeah, maybe not regretful, but like, well, I can't believe I just told him that. I barely know the guy. He's not my best mate, sort of thing.
Yeah, but you hold that space for him and it's not a problem.
Yeah, I suppose.
How do you feel after that?
Yeah, sometimes...
Because you got to do the next haircut straight away.
Yeah, well, with the heavy stuff, I take it in, I sort of process it. I might go for a quick piss. I might just run to the loo real quick and be like, shake off, and then come back in. But I don't know, it's a weird one. You kind of... I sometimes think that when you're working in a barbershop, you kind of got to leave your personal life at the door and be that professional, which is really difficult to do because
people are bringing their personal lives in.
Exactly. And it's like you can't have one rule for yourself and then another rule for anyone else. But then at the same time, I've been pretty hypocritical to that myself because I go through things and sometimes I have days where I'm just like, God, I hate my life today. Like this is so rubbish.
And it would be really noticeable in you.
Yeah, and I don't want that. I want people, so for some people, you're the first person that they even talk to. You know, the 8 a.m. session, they come in for a haircut. I haven't spoken to anyone else. They don't want to hear me talking about how I've had no sleep and my little boys kept me awake.
They're thinking this guy's going to do a shit haircut.
Exactly, you know, so I've got the old saying, service with a smile. So I grin and bear it. And then sometimes, like, I'll know the clients. Sometimes clients will be like, come, what's up? Like, I know there's something up. And then I'll pour my heart out to them sometimes. Like, I've got a select few clients that I will talk to about anything and everything. And they know that they can do the same with me. And it's weird. It's kind of like this unwritten agreement that we just, anything that's said in the barbershop stays in the barbershop. We say it quietly. No one, I don't think anyone else can hear. But it's like, obviously, they know the risks of talking to me with everyone else here, but they do it.
Yeah.
And it gets to that awkward moment, the hairdryer goes off and you're like, real nice weather, hey? But I like to think I do a pretty good job when I hear someone else's story and then I've got a client straight after. I kind of have no choice but to just crack on. And I might send them a text the next day, how you feeling and all of that. But
do you get emotionally exhausted from it or not particularly? Because it seems to me like barbering's a pretty involved job. Like you got to concentrate and do a good job. You don't really have many breaks all day. And then you have to listen to and talk to people the whole time too.
Yeah.
Like there's quite a lot of focus.
It does.
And if those conversations involve you having to hold space for someone who's genuinely struggling and talking about something pretty intense, like that's got to build up in you a bit. And that's sort of how I feel with the podcast sometimes is you have these conversations with people and
it's
well worth it because you know it's a good thing and it's meaningful and it does something for them. And in this case, it does something for other people who listen to it.
Yeah.
But there is an emotional intensity to taking on those stories and hearing that. And at some point, it can kind of make you feel a bit tired or like weigh on you.
Absolutely. I mean, I'll sometimes go home and my missus will look at me like, how's work? And she hates it when I just say, busy.
Yeah.
And it's like...
not a lie.
It's not a lie. It was really busy. But she'll look at me sometimes and she'll say, can you tell me something other than just busy? I know you were busy. And I'm like, I can't. I've had so many conversations. Sometimes I just want to chill out. Not that I don't want to speak to you. But you tell me about your day. I'm used to listening to people. I can do that all day. I do that for a living. I cut hair second. I'll listen to you first. And sometimes I just want to sort of kick back, watch a bit of TV and just start again the next day.
Yeah, well, you only got so much battery, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. But no, I do love it though. I love that I've created a space and I've created a persona that allows people to come to me and just chat away and feel comfortable enough to tell me their woes with, they know me, but we're not best mates. I could go out for a drink with many of them, but
I'm guessing your return rate's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got a lot. I would say I know, yeah, probably 90% of my clientele.
Yeah.
And there's a big amount of people. Hundreds.
And I don't doubt that your haircuts are bang on, but I'm guessing it's probably because of their personal side of it as well.
Haircuts are relatively shit, but it's just good chat. Great banter.
It's not much of a slogan, yeah, though, is it? Take us through your experience of being catfished.
That was fun. That was, I was 17. I was 17 and just, I was in the middle of my exams at high school. And high school in London, you had years 12 and 13. And they were called your A-levels. So I was doing year 12. And years 12 and 13, you'd have four subjects in year 12. You'd drop one, do year 13. And then whatever subject you were good at and you passed, you'd go to uni with that. So I was in year 12. I was studying God knows what subjects. I was in the middle of my exams. Awful. I did horrendously just because I was not academic and I didn't care. And towards the end of the exams, this girl on Facebook added me as a friend. And she was, she was like every guy's dream. She was just hot. She was just a good looking girl.
And you just didn't question it for a second.
Nah, didn't question that this girl could be fake. Yeah, accepted the friend request. She sends me a message and it wasn't one of these, she just seemed like a normal person. It wasn't.
Wasn't bad grammar, and obviously it was,
yeah, it wasn't
in
like
country.
Broken English. Like yeah. It just seemed like, you seem like a cool girl. And we were chatting. We spoke all night, just about random stuff. Chatting every day, every night.
How long did that go on for?
The whole process went on for 9-10 months.
Oh wow,
long time. And it quickly got to a point where we were talking on the phone every day, like every morning, every lunchtime. We'd be texting in between that.
Okay, so you could hear their voice.
Yeah. Had a really quirky London accent and just real fun, playful, and everything I liked, she seemed to like. And it didn't really seem to ring any alarm bells, but I would like really obscure old punk bands that my dad would tell me about and then be like, oh my God, the Ramones are my favorite punk band ever. And I'm like, how do you like the Ramones? Like, no one likes the Ramones. And all these things that were really, really cool. I was like, shit, she likes the same shit I like.
And did they claim to live somewhere else, or why did you never meet them?
She claimed to live in an area called Watford, which was on the other side of London. And every time we tried to meet up, every time I tried to meet up with her, it was the same. My granddad's just died. I've just split my head open. I'm really sick. My abusive dad has just come round and he won't let me move the house. Like, yeah. Really dark
you,
stuff.
You name it.
And there's me, damsel in distress. I want to be there for this girl. And I would have my friends from school, hey, do you want to come out tonight? And my mindset was, I've met my friends. I've got a good relationship with my friends. I'm going to put my energy into meeting this girl. And then my relationship with my family started breaking down because my parents would be like, where is this girl? When are we going to meet her? And be like, you'll meet her. And it hit points where I would pretend to go and meet her to shut them up. There were times where I would get the train into the city of London and I would sit on a bench, buy myself a little bit of lunch. I'd sit there for a couple of hours, get the train home. My mum would be like, how was your date with, her name was Charlie. How was your date with Charlie? And I was like, yeah, it was really good. Yeah, we went for lunch. We went to this restaurant.
And while you're sitting there, were you thinking like, it's pretty stupid that I'm sitting here having a fake date. Like, why am I having a fake date? Or were you genuinely not suspicious that this person wasn't real?
I just believed all these mistakes. And it was just like, I'm doing this to shut my mum up. This poor girl has just been abused by her dad. she needs to sort her stuff out, but my mum won't leave me alone.
Yeah.
So I'm just gonna go.
And you were just so well intentioned.
I just wanted to save this poor girl, and it just got really serious. There was a time when me and my family went to Florida for a family wedding, and she happened to be in Florida. I spent the whole time trying to meet up with her. I was using my mum's minutes, all of her credit, the foreign minutes that cost a lot of money, calling, hey, where are you? I'm in this place. And she'd be Googling places in Boca Raton, Florida, where I was. And I was like, I can come and meet you there. No, don't meet me there, I've just gone.
And then just got off on fucking with you to that level.
Turns out she was on the same flight as me on the way home.
Yeah, what are the chances?
And I even spoke to, oh my God. I think about it now and I'm like, wow, how did you fall for that? She was sitting in first class and I spoke to an air steward and I said, hey, is this girl sitting in first class? He said, I can't give that information. I'm like, of course you can't. And then we got to Heathrow Airport. And I'd call her straight away. I'm like, hey, like, where are you? She said, oh, I'm already in a cab home. And I'm like, why didn't you wait? Mm. She's like, I had to go. And I was like, oh my God.
Seems like you would have waited.
Yeah, I know. I was like, why wouldn't you wait? You're my girlfriend.
Oh,
and that's
man.
How we were. And
so how did it come to a head?
It was my 18th birthday. My mum had got in contact with her. She found her number. She got in contact with her and she invited. It was me, my mum, my dad, my brother. My two best mates that never left my side, and Charlie. And she'd organised this dinner, and I got to this dinner and there was a spare chair. And I said, who's that chair for? And my mum looked at me like brokenhearted. She was like, that's for Charlie. She was going to come, but she's really sick. So she's not going to make it. And I was like,
classic Charlie.
Classic, been there. But I was heartbroken. I went to the toilet, cried my eyes out, and I was like, when am I going to see this girl? So she essentially ruined my 18th birthday. Next day, mum says to me, this is ridiculous. There's a website that you can go on in England. I don't know if it's the same here. There's a website called 192.com or .co.uk where you can literally find someone's address. It's all something to do with the census. And my mum says, this is her address. I've called the mobile network, told them how serious it is, and unlawfully they have given me Charlie's address and they've confirmed it. Do you want to go and see her today? I'll take you there to her house. You can say that because she's not well, you're going there, you're going to give her some flowers and make her feel better. My whole world just came down. I was like, oh my God, this is it. I could meet Charlie. And I got there and the house that she sent pictures of me, like to me, was this big, beautiful mansion in Watford with a lake at the back.
That was not it.
It was not it. We went there and I was like, whoa.
Red flag.
Big red flag. I saw the dog.
There's no moat.
No, nothing. And I saw her and we left the note for her mum at the door because no one was home. And mum called us like 5 minutes down the road. She was like, I've just seen your letter. Can you please come back? We get back. My phone starts ringing. And ringing, you could feel. And then my mum's phone started ringing. My mum looked at me, she was, do not answer that. That is Charlie, and she's gonna give you some bullshit excuse not to go there. Got to the house, and I showed a picture of Charlie to her mum. Her mum was sweet, she was a really nice lady. And she looked at me, she's like, that's not my daughter. And I'm like, shock, I saw that coming. And then I answered the phone, I said, look, I've spoken to your mum, just come round. Like, I've fallen in love with the person that you are, not just your looks. She just lost it. She went mad. But like literally like the next day I was like, I'm so happy that's over. And like literally because I had that closure.
So you never saw her?
Never saw her. Never met her. Spoke to her maybe a month later and I just said, I called her. I messaged her, I was like, hey, can I call you? She calls me up and I said, why did you do it? Like I was really not well. There was a point within that 9 months, I was pretty, I had some suicidal thoughts. It was really dark. It got really, really dark. I actually wrote a little mini book about it, like the whole period. Maybe about 10 years later, I wrote it.
And what was behind that? when, my missus, when you were suicidal, when not when you were suicidal, when you were
my missus,
when when you were suicidal, when you were struggling a lot, like what was underneath that?
I was being such a shit at home, and my parents, they didn't threaten to throw me out, but not in those words, but it was, I had such an amazing relationship with them, and I essentially just stopped talking to them because all of my cards were on this Charlie girl, and it was Valentine's Day, and I never got a card. Something so simple, but I never got a card on Valentine's Day, and I called her up. I was like, "Hey, did you send me a card?" She's like, "Yeah, yeah, I sent it to you. I sent it to you like a week ago." And I'm like, "It's not there." And I remember putting my headphones on and just went for a walk in the pouring rain. February in London is pretty grim. And I remember I walked for ages, and I found myself on essentially a freeway, like a dual carriageway. But yeah, I found myself on the side of a freeway thinking to myself, my parents hate me, my brother hates me, got no friends, I've pushed them all out. This Charlie girl clearly doesn't give a shit. No one would really care if I sort of stepped in front of a car right now.
Yeah, so that classic narrative that people talk about with that voice in your head.
When no one cares about
it. It's crept up on you, and that's just you telling yourself that.
Yeah.
But it feels like someone else sometimes. And
yeah.
None of that's true, but you're believing in that lie to such an extent that you were on the edge of doing that,
100%.
Which must seem crazy to you years later.
Looking back at it now, thinking, wow, I was that person. It's scary. It's really, really scary.
And I think teenagers particularly feel emotions so intensely, especially around relationships and that sort of thing. Like there's never a more intense time than when you're going through that phase of development and you think everything's so be all and end all and it's never going to get better than this or that. This has to work out and you just put your whole heart and soul into things, and it's so easy to get crushed.
100%.
And just being short-sighted, of course, because you're inexperienced as to how much more life there is to live.
Exactly. I think in saying that, I don't think teenagers, they haven't lived long, you know, and they obviously don't have.
There's no evidence of that you're going to feel better.
They don't value life as much as, say, what me and you would. They don't understand it. They haven't lived a lot. They've only lived a small portion of it, and a small portion of it might have been really, really difficult. They don't realise that there's another potential like 70, 80 years to actually have a really good time on this planet that we're all on. And, you know, it's like thinking back to 17-year-old Grant that was standing on the freeway to 31-year-old Grant that's got a beautiful wife, amazing little boy, two successful businesses and stuff. Like, fuck, if I did something like that now, I'd be throwing a lot away, like so much. Whereas if I did it at 17, Grant would be thinking, I'm not throwing much away, I'll just go to school.
But you never would have become this Grant.
But I never would have become this Grant, exactly. So there's so much potential in these poor teenagers that are ending their lives. They've all got so much potential and they don't get it. They don't realise it.
And not just teenagers as well, you know, men our age or older.
Of course, yeah.
Anyone where you're caught in that moment and you're hearing exactly that story that you just told of, I'm worthless, people would be better off without me, I'm a burden. And you're believing in that and it's never true. And if you can just get through that 24 hours or that week or whatever it is, then you come to realise that that was a lie and you do have a lot of value and that things do get better.
Yeah.
But the tragedy is you believe it at that time. And for some people, just believing it for a moment is enough to make that mistake.
And people forget you're not well, you know, you're not
in your right mind. Yeah.
You're not well, you're not in your right mind, you're essentially sick, you know. The brain, like if you try and pinch yourself, you can't actually hurt yourself because your brain stops you from inflicting that pain. But to be able to be so unwell, to inflict so much pain where you essentially end your life,
it's not rational.
No, of course. Your brain's full of nonsense telling you that you're worthless and stuff, and that's when you need help, when you start thinking those things.
And that's why speaking it out loud can really help
100%.
To someone like your barber or whoever it might be, because
absolutely.
Once you hear that out loud, you can piece together whether or not that makes sense. Or someone can tell you, hey, you're not actually thinking all that straight right now. Maybe you should look at it another way.
100%.
So what did that girl say to you about why she did it?
Not a lot. I said to her, like, do you know what you've done to my life? I said to her, do you know what you've done to my life? Like, you've ruined it. You know, I don't know if I'm going to come back from this. Like, you have messed up my family, my friendship groups, everything. I almost lost my job. I was just worked at little hairdressers. I was washing the little old lady's hair. But that job took me to where I am. But you almost lost me my job, everything. And she just said, I just got caught up in it. I got carried away. And I'm like, you have no idea how detrimental that could have been. You could have ended my life. And I found out she was doing it to like 8 other guys. And I remember getting in contact with one of those guys. And I said to him, like, hey, man, do you know who I am? He was like, yeah, you're friends with Charlie. You work with her, don't you? And I'm like, no. She told me that you work with her. And he was like, no, she's my girlfriend. I'm like,
she created this whole network of it.
Yeah, so many.
She must have just been doing messages and calls all day.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was. Yeah.
And it's just an obsession for some people. Yeah.
She would have had so much time on her hands. much time on her hands. There were so many guys she was doing it to. And I actually got contacted by MTV. Catfish UK.
That show,
Contacted by Catfish UK. I don't think the show ended up airing, but they weren't interested in me because I'd already gone through it. Yeah. I wasn't going through it at that
They couldn't
point.
Take you over there for it.
Which I'm pretty thankful
for. Yeah, that's a horrible experience, though, to go through as a young person. How did you come out of that and trust people again and rebuild things?
I just knew that there were people still there to support me. It's like my two best mates. Like, I called them up the next day and I'd be like, you will never guess what I found out yesterday.
You're like, I fucking told you.
Yeah, literally, I told you. And I remember my mate, Robert, he actually came round that day and we just went for a walk, the longest walk I've ever had, longer than that other one. And we just smoked, I think we smoked like a pack of cigarettes between us and we just walked and I told him everything. And he was just like, Jesus, I had no idea. And then my other friend, she's like my little sister. I think it was her birthday the next day after that walk. And she was like, just come to my birthday party. Usually I would never have gone to that party, like within that 9 months. And I was just like, you know what? Like, fuck it, I'm gonna go. All of my old schoolmates were there. They were so happy to see me. They were like, oh my God, Grant's here. Like, let's give him some love. And I just realized how many people got around me and it was amazing. It was such an incredible feeling. I went on a boys' holiday like maybe like 3 months later. I just booked the last minute ticket. Like my mate Robert, he was like, you're coming with us.
Yeah. And started living like
it
should have been.
If I'm honest, it was like there was a switch. The moment I got that clarity and like closure that I'd been essentially talking to this made up person for the last 9 months, the moment I realized for fact and I'd heard the words, she's not real, it was almost like there was a light switch and I just completely changed into
and that there was
again.
All these people that cared about you and they weren't just going to shame
mom,
you
my
over
dad.
It.
Yeah. And I never got any, you were an idiot, I can't believe what you did. It was almost...
Because it was so legit and went
was,
on for
yeah,
so long.
Yeah, it was real.
And it was, people could pick up on the seriousness of that.
100%.
And it shows you, actually, there was all these people who really did care about you.
Yeah.
And so what you were thinking at that, in those dark moments, was just so far from the truth.
100%.
And why did you move to Australia?
My missus. Yeah, we...
Who was real and is real.
Who is definitely real. She was living in London at the time. She's a teacher. She was living in London and doing what most Aussie teachers do, just qualify, move to London, go and travel Europe and run out of money and then go back. And she actually was she's an English teacher, or she was teaching English then. And I told her my story. I told her the catfishing story. And she told me, you need to write that in a book. And I wrote it down and I've sent it to a few people over the years. And I'm really happy she told me to do that because I would have never have done it. But yeah, no, we met and became friends and fell in love. Like the whole, all of that ended up, she ended up getting a really good job opportunity here in Adelaide. And she said, look, I love you. Don't want to break up with you, but I've also been given this job. Like, what do you want me to do? And I'm like, well, I'm not going to hold you back. So I just thought, you go and do your thing. I'm going to spend another few months here with my family. And I've never been to Australia. Like, I'll come out for a year. I'll see what it's like. If I move out there, we don't get on, whatever. And if we do, I will cross that bridge when it comes. But that was a really, really tough time because I came from such a warm and close family that never argued unless you got catfished. we were always tight.
It's a lot to give up.
Yeah, and for me to, and I had a really good job in London, working with some amazing people, and I was essentially
throwing caution to the wind,
throwing it all away, and moving to this tiny little beautiful city.
Yeah, and I bet your parents backed you though, still to do it.
No,
they didn't.
At the beginning, they absolutely hated it.
Yeah, no, right.
They hated it because I'm the youngest. I was their little boy. Still am their little boy. They'll argue, and
they didn't believe it would work out.
No, they didn't. I don't think. And at the time, I had a really lovely girlfriend, really lovely Jewish girlfriend, and like I said before, like my family were fairly traditional. When I broke up with her. And ended up getting with this Catholic Aussie girl. They were like, she's not Jewish. That was the first bit.
Right, okay.
So first it was like, hang on, you're going out with a non-Jewish girl.
All right, so that's a bit tough too.
That was tough. That was a tough pill for him to swallow. Next minute,
She's stealing our son.
She's stealing me and moving to the other side of the world. So the Jewish thing, that was quickly forgotten about. And they were like, hang on, you're not moving to Australia.
Yeah. Shit.
And it was a tough, like, for that first year here, I didn't have a good relationship with my parents. It was every phone call I made.
Because they were angry at you?
They were not angry at me, they were angry at the situation.
Yeah.
They loved me so much and vice versa. They didn't want to lose me and they were so scared of losing that bond that we had.
So it was out of love, but they just weren't willing to give you up.
Being a selfish parent.
Yeah.
You know, like, if my little boy turned around and said to me, Dad, he's 10 months old, I'd be pretty impressed. But if he turned around and said to me, Dad, I'm moving to the other side of the world.
Yeah. You'd say, have you got eyes on her first? Because that's really key.
I'd be like, I really don't want you to go. I would, like, if someone said to me now, I can't see my boy. Oh, fuck.
That wouldn't sit right with you.
Nah, that would kill me. So
you can imagine that. You got that different compassion, don't you?
Now I'm a parent.
Yeah.
I haven't been a parent for very long. I've got a 10-month bond. When I was 25 and moved out here, or 24, that's a 24-year bond that my parents were having to let go. Yeah. So now I get a rough idea of how they're feeling. But at the same time, you can't live your life to please someone else. And I spent a lot of my life doing that. I spent a lot of my life, still do. I still make sure, or try and make sure, everyone else is happy before me, which isn't healthy to do. Like, you shouldn't do that. But I've always believed that, for me, everyone needs to be happy first.
Mm.
Then I'll sort myself out.
So it must have killed you to leave then?
Because I was going against everything I've always stood for. Mm. For the first time, I was putting me first, and I was upsetting so many people.
But you just had a gut feeling that that was the right call.
Yeah, I just wanted to. Yeah, I just wanted to do it. You know, she's a special girl, and I suppose a lot of people couldn't see that at the beginning. Now, my parents have been here 4 times. They've seen what a life I've made. They've met my missus. And they love her to pieces.
They're like, she's not evil.
She's not evil. It's all right. Like, shit, okay. And they've seen what a life we've built together. And
so it was the right call.
100%.
But a hard call to make.
Hard call, the right call. And I used to say, if my missus ever broke up with me, I'd just move back to England. But now I can sort of, I can't say that now because I've got a little one here. I've got a little boy, and it's like now it's solidified. I've got a life here. Doesn't mean England's not home, but yeah, here's home as well. Here's where your home's where your family is, yeah. You know. But yeah, no, it's definitely a good call.
So that was 7 years ago now.
I've been saying 7 years for ages now. I actually worked out in August it will be 8 years, which is, yeah, this year's already disappearing.
Yeah.
But
so in 12 years you'll be an Aussie.
I'll never be an Aussie. Yeah. I can never call myself an Aussie. Even if my accent tweaks a little bit, I can't do it.
Were you already a barber when you came over?
Yeah. Yeah. I started off hairdressing because I failed miserably in my exams because of Charlie.
Yeah. Blame it on Charlie.
Yeah. The girl.
Yeah, yeah.
Failed all my exams. Became a hairdresser for about 4 years. Did an apprenticeship. Realised that working with
romantic, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Working with nothing but women for four years really, it really took it out of me.
Not my strong suit.
Yeah, I was like, I need to work with some guys.
Yeah.
And got my barbering qualifications, and yeah, been cutting hair for almost 15 years now. But yeah, love it. It's awesome.
And you mentioned your businesses. Tell us about those. So you got a few shops.
Got two shops. Chaps Barbershop. We opened them. My two business partners, Sam and Andy. They were just clients of mine at the shop I used to manage. And I think they just saw so much. They saw how hard I worked. They saw the potential in me. We always had a good chat, and for a few months they badgered me. Like, they really badgered me. Like, let's open a shop together. Let's do it. And those two are best mates, have been for years.
Yeah.
And I'd had an argument with my boss one day, and Andy walked past and he was like, "What's wrong with you?" And I'm like, "Oh, just had this huge Barney, like it's just been mad." And he was like, "You know, that offer still stands." And I was like, "Have you got a location?" He said, "Yeah, we've got a location." And I just went inside, I booked the lunch break, and I was like, "Come on, let's go and have a look." I think 2 weeks later, we signed a partnership agreement and signed a lease and everything, and that was that. I haven't looked back, and those two boys have been awesome. They have pushed me to do things that I would never have done on my own. And yeah, really thankful I came across two mates like that, because I suppose they believed in me. I never really believed in myself. I kind of just accepted I'd always work for someone. But
you must now, though.
Now I do, yeah. I do look at myself, and I've done well for myself.
You've got the evidence now.
Yeah, I've, you know, the bank account might not say it, but the love my clients have for me, and the love I got for my clients, and the amazing space, and the reviews I see go up, and what people tell me, like, "Grant, you've done really well for yourself. You should be proud of yourself." And like, finally I see, I've done all right. I've done okay, and I am proud of myself. And
yeah.
I do look back at 17-year-old Grant and think, fuck.
You would have missed out a lot.
Yeah, would have missed out a shit ton. And so I'm proud, definitely.
You should be, man.
Thanks, man.
Tell us about this big fundraiser.
The big fundraiser. Oh, gosh.
Which is the second one that you've done.
The second one, yeah. So the first one I did, so basically I'm cutting hair for 24 hours straight to raise money for the Shaka Project, who you've spoken with.
Yeah, we've had Sean on the show.
Yeah, you've had Sean on a couple of times.
Yeah, a couple of times.
Yeah, so before that, going back a few years ago, I just had this stupid idea of I want to cut hair for 24 hours. Just see if I can do it.
And which is about how many haircuts?
48. If you're doing half an hour haircuts, 48 haircuts.
Yep. And they're shit or they're right?
Oh, awful. First couple will be all right, but you don't want to be you don't want to be the 40th client to say that. But I just always wanted to challenge myself, and I was talking to a client and he said, "Why don't you do it for charity?" And I was like, "Oh, I suppose that's a better idea." And back then I had this amazing little boy. He used to come in and get his hair cut, and he was quite severely autistic, and he He came in, didn't say a word, screamed, was terrified, would not let me near him. And over the weeks, he would come in again with his parents, and I would see how his parents would struggle. And eventually, I gave him this full haircut, watching his parents well up. And I thought, wow, I've made those people so proud of their son. I've given them, I've done that sort of thing. And it was with my patience and stuff. And this little boy now, he still comes to see me. He's incredible. Comes in, he talks a little bit now, and he's the best. And I just thought to myself, I'm going to do something for parents that have children with special needs, autism, that whole thing. And I stumbled across Autism SA and contacted them, asked the parents of the little boy, and they said, yeah, they're a really nice group of people. And then ended up raising like $9,500 for Autism SA, and I did this grueling challenge. And it was so cool having the media outlets come in, the radio, and it was cool, it was wicked. And I said to myself, I'm gonna do this every year. Haven't done it every year. And I thought to myself, I've got to do it because it's wicked. And I sat down a few months ago and I was like, what shall I do? And I thought, I'll change it up. I don't want to do it just for children, you know, because there's adults that need help as well. And now I have way too many kids that come in the salon. And it's like, I need some other people in now. And yeah, I was scrolling through Instagram and I already followed the Shaka Project. And I was like, I like these guys. Don't know too much about them. Did a bit of reading. And I thought, I'm gonna send the proceeds to them. So yeah, we're doing it again in a couple of weeks' time. 48 haircuts have been booked in. You're coming in.
I mean, which number am I?
What time are you
coming
in?
Hopefully not 48.
What time are you coming?
I reckon afternoon. I reckon like 4 p.m. or something.
So you're
is that the next day?
You're in a normal day's work. You'll just get like an average haircut.
Yeah, right. Yeah, better be good, mate.
Yeah.
High expectations. Yeah, we'll see. Yeah. How do you go cutting hair for 48 hours? Is it, you know?
24 hours. No,
24
you're
hours,
all good.
Sorry. Yeah, yeah.
How do I go? When I last did it, it was everyone that came in, I knew. They were all really good, well-known clients of mine. And so it sort of kind of just felt like my mates were coming in to support me and they knew they were getting a dog shit haircut. And they were just supporting
they
a mate.
They were copying it.
Were just supporting a mate.
So you got,
and giving some money
to charity.
You got
randoms coming in this time that you don't know.
We know each other now.
We're well acquainted
we're
now.
We're good
bro.
Now. I think there's two people that are coming in that I have never met, and I'm...
Yeah.
They won't be returning customers.
Yeah, right. I don't believe that.
I think they just want to help. I think they like the cause that I'm doing it for.
Yeah,
and
awesome.
Look, do you know what? It might be, they might sit down in the chair and they might be one of those people that open up to me. Because
and you're like, look, man, I got 47 more haircuts to do.
Yeah, I'm like,
not today,
man. We're not getting deep.
Take it somewhere else. There.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's really difficult, but it is so rewarding at the end. Like when you do the 48th haircut, and you put down your clippers, and you're like, how much money did we raise? And you see the number, and like. It's awesome to know that you've raised that much money for a tiny little charity that a lot of people might not know about. And it's cool. And you put the word out there for them and it's, I don't know, you're just helping. I always like helping people. I've always been like it. So knowing that I'm helping someone, yeah, it's cool. It's a warming feeling.
Yeah, it's so cool. And it's a credit to you, man, to do something like that. And credit to you for having shops like you've got and having that culture and that environment.
Yeah.
I think it's no accident that you've created the life that you have and that you're surrounded by a lot of good people who value you and you in return, you know. That's no coincidence, mate. You get back what you put out. So,
yeah. Thank you, man.
You're a good man.
Appreciate
and Dan,
that.
You got a cool story too, so thanks for
Thank
sharing
you,
that
brother.
With us.
Cheers, my man.
And I'm looking forward to the shit haircut.
Yeah, me too.
That's it for this episode. If you like what we're all about, support us by following Youngblood Men's Mental Health on Instagram and Youngblood Mental Health on TikTok. Every podcast episode is recorded in professional quality video and they're all up on our Youngblood Men's Mental Health YouTube channel. So please show some love and subscribe. Thanks to our local business supporters, NBNA Group and Pro Realty Property Consultants. You can find everything there is to know about the podcast at youngbloodmensmentalhealth.com. And most importantly, please share these stories with anyone in your life who needs to know they're not alone. We're all in this together. Catch you next time.